Welcome to the Jazz Piano School Podcast with Brendan Lowe, episode number 21. You're going to love this one.
Welcome to the Jazz Piano School Podcast.
Learn jazz piano without all the guesswork.
Now, your host, Brendan Lowe.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Jazz Piano School Podcast. This is episode number 21, and again, my name is Brendan Lowe. I am your host. Thank you so much for listening. I'm super excited right now because I'm able to share this great episode with you. Today, we had a very, very special guest, an amazing mentor to me, and I'm sure many, many others, and phenomenal jazz pianist, educator, leader on the jazz scene today by the name of Eric Reed. And he was my teacher back when I was studying at the New School University, and he was so kind, and he, you know, opened his doors to me, brought me around to gigs, got me into free to his gigs, was always inviting me out to go hear music and hang out, and introduced me to people such as McCoy Tyner and Benny Green, and just really provided me with all this these opportunities that no one else could have ever done. So I'm just so thankful for him and what he did for me, and coming on the show as well and giving us his time today. So he's such a kind person. It was just great to have this conversation with him and hear him talk about jazz today and share his opinions on the music and just really get into some nitty-gritty things about the rhythm section we talked about a lot and just music in general. So it's a really, really good interview. I'm sure you'll be able to take a lot of key points and information from this interview to help you progress and learn. So before we get into the interview, I just want to share that the podcast is connected to my website, www.jazzpianoschool.com. If you go there, there's many, many resources for you to check out. You can check out the blog. You can check out the podcast episodes. You can become a free member and watch instructional videos on certain topics that you may be interested in. There's just a whole slew of information there at your disposal whenever you want it. So I'd encourage you to go check out the website, www.jazzpianoschool.com. So without further ado, let's get right into the episode. Here is Eric Reed. Today I'm privileged to have one of the most influential teachers and mentors whose style and playing I've loved and listened to since I was about 12 years old. Eric Reed, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Piano School Podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Eric. Now, you've made over 20 albums as a leader. You've had tons more as a sideman. You've performed countless tours with practically everyone on the jazz scene and can't be around jazz these days without having your name come up, you know, somehow. And through all that, you still found time to teach me at New School and other students. So to get started, I'd love for you to share what this extensive musical journey has been like for you.
Oh, goodness. That's a loaded question. I mean, it keeps me asking questions. Mm-hmm. I've been enjoying myself. That's obvious. But it keeps me asking questions with regard to what I'm doing, what I want to change, what I would have done differently had I had the opportunity. As an artist, it's such a different existence than the normal, everyday existence that I think the average person experiences. Mm. So I don't think any artist is ever 100% certain of themselves, of their decisions, even when they're successful, even when their decisions have led to whether it's monetary success or fame or artistic, whatever it is. To me, genuine artistry is constantly about asking questions and making pit stops to reevaluate, revamp, and a system of checks and balances that says, okay, yeah, this is okay. Yes, I'm on the right track. Kind of measuring yourself up against your own standards and against the standards of your given field.
Hmm, I see. Now, can you give us a specific example? Are you talking about recordings you've done or, gigs you've played, things like that?
Everything. Every single thing. I question everything that I do and everything that I've done. And I try to measure it up against what it is I want to do, the types of gigs I want to do, the type of musicians that I'm playing with, the types of records that I'm making. And I don't always find myself satisfied with every single thing, which means I've got to keep doing it. And I don't know that any artist ever becomes 100% satisfied with everything they've done. If they were always that way, there wouldn't really be any point in continuing to do it.
Right.
You have to keep double-checking just to make sure that, yeah, this is cool. I mean, you look at Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder would never have gotten from the 1960s to the 1980s without constantly trying to keep his finger on the pulse of the people, maintaining a level of relevance and communicating things that are relevant to what's happening in the time. Otherwise, you're really just reciting poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really communicating. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's okay. What are those music goals that you're speaking of then? And have they changed over the years since you were younger? Because, you broke into the scene very young. So how has that evolved over time?
I've been rethinking why I decided to do what I'm doing. At an early age, I made a decision to focus specifically on jazz music. And a large part of that is because it was such a great challenge for me. And I developed a passion for the music at an even earlier age, at age 5 or 6. I was exposed to everything when I was around that age. I can't even remember what music I was exposed to first, as if it even matters. But I know for a fact that my parents, we were all very heavily involved in church. My father was a Baptist minister, so there's a good chance that the first music I heard may have been gospel music, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother plays guitar, and he loves R&B, and my father loved gospel quartets, the Dixie Hummingbirds and the Soul Stirrers, groups mm-hmm. like that. And my mother just loved music. But I was also always surrounded by music and people in church. So I always heard singing and playing. And there was always, the radio. So I was exposed to a great deal at a very early age. But somewhere along the way, I made a decision. Not a conscious one. It wasn't like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It's something that just kind of happened. And I wound up making a heavy focus on jazz music. So I'm reevaluating and rethinking all of that because there's so much music that I love. In my sets nowadays, I may incorporate anything from 80s rock to 70s R&B, not so much stylistically, but just from the music itself. Because at the end of the day, music is music. So if it's good, I'll gravitate towards it. If it's bad, that's really a matter of personal taste. So I gravitate to anything, any melody that speaks to me, whether it's by Stevie Wonder or whether it's by the Porcaro family, whether it's by Donnie Hathaway or David Foster, who wrote all these wonderful hits for Earth, Wind & Fire. I don't see a melody like Billy Joel wrote a song called Honesty, which I recorded some years ago. I don't see a melody like Honesty any differently than a melody like Body and Soul. Beauty is beauty.
Mm-hmm.
So where I am now, I'm just embracing whatever I find to be beautiful. And I don't care what genre it's in. Music is music. And there's some way within the framework of my artistry, I'm going to find some way to fit it into the design, into the architecture, or the arc, of the set, and tie it all together. Because there's somebody right. in the audience, who's probably not even a jazz fan.
Right.
So I want to reach that person, not in a commercial way, just in a way of communication and content.
So, I mean, one of my questions was what has inspired you throughout the years, but it seems like these days you're taking a little bit from everything, all your inspirations and, musical influences. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I didn't always embrace that outright. There were some things that I just said, no, I'm not going to deal with that, because in the jazz idiom, it's such a... There's so much information to digest, and just learning how to play the music itself is complicated. Having to have a certain amount of facility on your instrument, first of all, and then just dealing with the music, dealing with the lineage of jazz piano, just the piano itself, forget about the other instruments, just being a piano player and dealing with the lineage of jazz piano all the way from Scott Joplin through Jelly Roll Morton, up to whoever's playing now, and always keeping my ears open to what's going on, because there's an idea of relevance just in the terms of not the passing fancies or the trends or any type of commercialism, just listening to the sounds of what is happening at this moment, the people that are creating new music now. I want to know what's going on. I want to be aware of it, I want to listen to it, and I want to be open to it so that I can continue to evolve.
For the younger students who haven't gone through as many experiences as you have, are there certain key elements that you can remember back to that helped you more than others as you were first getting started?
Being available.
Hmm.
When I was in my teen years, mid-teens, 16, 17, late teens, I had opportunities to work with amazing musicians. Teddy Edwards, Sweets Edison, Billy Higgins, Gerald and John Clayton, Ray Brown. A lot of those musicians, I think all the ones that I just mentioned, except for the Claytons, are gone now. And this, to me, is the sad part about the scene now, is that these young musicians don't really have the same kinds of opportunities that I had to work with older musicians who were interested in hiring younger musicians. People like Charles Lloyd, he hires younger guys. Benny Golson, Wayne Shorter, but they don't do it on as regular a basis. I mean, because the turnaround isn't as frequent. Wayne Shorter kept the same band together for some time now, and I'm not one to judge or try to tell somebody how they should operate or how they should function, but I've always seen music performance as a mentoring environment. Herbie's good for hiring young musicians, Herbie Hancock. But imagine if a young drummer like Evan Sherman, Darian Douglas, I'm trying to think of guys in their 20s, could get the experience of playing with Keith Jarrett. Keith Jarrett had the same band together with Gary Peacock and Jack DeJohnette for 30 years. 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not making that, I'm not stating that to cast aspersions at the concept. Keith likes what he likes. That's his prerogative. That's his prerogative. And I think it would benefit the entire scene if there was more of a cross-generational type of fellowship or interaction. Chick Corea also is known for hiring their musicians. But by the same token, the music can't evolve as well or as efficiently unless you have the same group of musicians playing with each other all the time. And then at which point that group starts to become stale, then it's time to make a change. If you can go to a performance and pretty much predict what it's going to sound like, then maybe that's a problem. Maybe. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. You think about the modern jazz quartet. They were together 25, 30 years. Then they broke up. John Lewis regrouped. Then they got back together. I just think it's great for everybody to have an opportunity to be able to interact with and fellowship with masters. Now, Keith Jarrett is an obvious anomaly because he's Keith Jarrett. Everything about him is completely abnormal with regard to the scene, with regard to how he operates, with regard to his personality, his music, all that stuff. So that might not be the best example. But again, there are some wonderful musicians who miss out on the opportunity to play with a Keith or a Jack or a Gary, largely because they mostly play with each other. You know what I'm saying? And I guess for me, I like playing with different musicians. More often now, I'm playing with some of the same musicians all the time because I'm trying to work on some different group conceptions. And you can't do that when you have different musicians all the time. It's impossible. You can't work out a group conception as an individual unless you have the same musicians playing in the group. Now, you can work out ideas with different musicians, but you can't get to a flow or any kind of empathy unless you're able to communicate that vision to the same musicians over a succession of nights. That's what a band is, and that's how a band essentially becomes a band, is by doing the same stuff and making mistakes and fixing those mistakes and coming back the next night and then making new mistakes. You know, that's what a band is. That's why Duke Ellington's sound was so integral to jazz music. Keith Jarrett, Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, Miles Davis, all of these musicians who had working bands and musicians who have working bands now, Charlie Hayden, Wayne Shorter, Joshua Redman, Pat Metheny, Chick Corea. You know, they use the same musicians, Ron Carter. They use the same musicians all the time, and you get to a flow. And that's better for the audience, too. Then you don't get this idea of a jam session taking place. A bunch of musicians have come together, and they've rehearsed some tunes, rehearsed a few arrangements, and now we're going to play these gigs. A lot of the music is now gig-oriented versus band-oriented for any number of reasons, whether it's economy, you know, social, economic, blah, blah, whatever it is, any number of reasons for why these things are the way they are. But one of the things that I've been able to do is I've got specific things that I like for bassists and drummers to do on specific songs. So I'm able to communicate that to the musicians and achieve some semblance of a band sound. But it's not a band. It's just really more of a band sound.
Can you talk about those elements a little bit, like between the drummer and the bass player?
On ballads in particular, very specific with regard to ballads, I have the drummer play colors versus time. Mm. The standard way that most jazz drummers play ballads is to sweep on the snare drum with the brushes and then play the hi-hat on 2 and 4. And I completely do away with that because I'm trying to achieve a different conception of playing and communicating when I'm playing ballads. When I'm playing that slow, I want there to be a feeling of kind of just floating in space. Playing ballads now is different than playing ballads in the 30s and the 40s because nobody's dancing. That's what they call it, the ballad tempo. A ballad tempo in 1930-something was actually a dance tempo. It was a slow dance, though. And not slow dance like we used to do in the 70s. You know what I'm saying? I'm mean, talking about, you know, 70, 80 years ago. but I think the intent was probably the same. But the way I play ballads now is I have the bass player play time. And I ask him to, you know, be kind of heavy on half notes and some quarter notes just in terms of passing tones and things like that. Mm-hmm. But he's holding it down, holding down the time. So I'm trusting him to lay the time down. It's tricky for the bass player because that's probably not what he's accustomed to doing. Most of us are accustomed to the drummer controlling or dictating the time. And now the bass player has the potential to do that. So he's got to be sure of what's going on, which means I have to trust him. And he also has to trust me. You know, he has to know that even though I'm not playing inside of the bar line, I'll find it. I always tell bass players, don't try to catch up to me. And don't try to fall back and find out where I am. I always know where you are, and that's the most important thing. If you don't know where you are, then we're going to have a problem. So don't worry about where I am. You stay where you are, where you know the time to be. If the bass player has good time, it'll be okay. And then I'll just play lines around what he's doing. And then the drummer is basically reacting to everything that's happening in the music. But he's not playing time. He is, but he isn't. You see what I'm saying? He's not playing rigid. He's not playing rigid time with the hi-hat on 2 and 4. He's playing colors. So he's splashing on the cymbals, a little sweeping here and there. And I think it presents a different kind of challenge for the drummer. Because I know drummers sometimes get bored with playing time. Mm-hmm. And when you listen to drum-led groups, you hear them experimenting with different rhythms and different meters and things like that more often than you hear with other musicians. Because the drummer, he knows what's going on rhythmically more so than everybody else in the band. So he's not necessarily thinking about the melody so much as the groove or the feeling from song to song. And drummers more often than not know how to program sets of music as well as other musicians because they understand about tempos. It's like, so you know, we don't put these two tempos back to back because they're the same. Well, I played this on that last song. We already played an Afro-Cuban song, so let's do a different kind of groove here. Well, we've been playing 4-4 all night. Can we switch to 3-4? Can we switch to 5? Or at some point in the song, can we switch the meter? You know, the drummers are very creative when it comes to rhythmic dynamism.
Now, are there certain elements, like you were just discussing the ballad, things that you particularly like or enjoy or dislike on faster or medium swing tempos or, you know, maybe a faster tempo such as Cherokee or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Did you ask me a question? I'm sorry, I thought you were just making a mistake.
Yeah, that's okay. I was just saying, are there things, like you talked about the ballad, are there things you like or even dislike when you're playing with your rhythm section on faster tempos or, you know, pieces like Cherokee or even medium swing tempos that you don't like them to play?
I don't know necessarily. Generally, I like the rhythm section to have an edge. I have a tendency to rush. So it often feels to me as though the drummer may be dragging. But I just tell the drummers, it's like, look, even though I rush, you have to rush with me. Now, whether or not you think it's right or wrong, it's not the issue. I'm the one writing the check, so I'm all up rushing. That's just how it goes. You know, whether I'm right or wrong, I'm writing the check, and that's always right. Drummers that I tend to hire or work with tend to have that certain kind of edge. And the ride cymbal has to be the strongest element or the strongest component in the kit. I need to hear a strong ride cymbal. And if I can't feel it, it's just not going to work.
When you're listening, too, is the other thing I was interested in listening to the band in different parts, you know, such as during the melody, during your solo, during when you're comping for a soloist. Are there certain things like that you're specifically listening for in different situations?
Always the ride cymbal.
always the ride.
For the drummer.
Mm-hmm. Hey,
and this is oversimplified, but if the ride cymbal is the only part of the kit that the drummer, ironically, has on stage, that's fine with me. I'm serious. I mean, if it was a situation where you put a gun to my head and said, look, we can't have the entire kit on the stage, or the stage is so small, we can't fit drums. You can fit one thing on the bandstand. What's it going to be? I'm going to say the ride cymbal. Because the ride cymbal, for me, is what propels what I do. I'm the type of piano player who plays off of the drummer. Now, I almost said I'm the type of drummer. But a pianist is a percussion instrument. So it's like the drums, because it's a hammer striking the string. So I'm looking for somebody who's going to be as percussive as I am with the feeling of the music. And the ride cymbal, I mean, it's got to be clear. And I'm sure I can be a real pain in the ass when it comes to most drummers, because I've also got a specific cymbal sound that I'm hearing. I tend to prefer cymbals that have a significant amount of wash and a short amount of decay, because I like having the feeling of the sustaining sound or vibe when I'm playing. Mm. So a flat ride is not going to do a damn thing for me. I can't make it. I tend to prefer cymbals with rivets. A dry cymbal, again, does nothing for me. I think a dry cymbal might sound better behind a bass or a bass solo, because the bass frequencies are so low. You don't want to have something that's going to clutter up the sound of the bass or wash out the sound of the bass. So maybe a ride cymbal might need to be a little drier behind a bass, behind a bass solo. But behind me, because the overtone series of the piano, the harmonic series, is just so extensive, it's nice having that blend of other overtones and other washy sounds, I guess, from the cymbal to blend with the sound of the piano.
Wow. That's interesting. I've never even thought about that before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a matter of knowing what it is you want. So when I'm performing, I know what I like to hear. And my concern is always with reconciling what I want to hear with what the musician has to offer. Because once you start getting too specific, then it's just time for you to, like, sample your favorite drummer and then make a track and then play with that. You know what I'm saying? at some point, you're going to have to accept what it is the musician does, and if you've got a short list of things where it's like all the pros are over here and then there's like two cons, then you make that work. Unless those two things that are in the list of cons is so extreme that you can't really make music. You know, a lot of what we do as artists that interact with the group dynamic is a matter of acceptance. It's a matter of saying, okay, I like this guy enough. He's got enough of these things that I like. I'm going to stick with this for a minute. That drummer for me has always been Gregory Hutchinson. Gregory Hutchinson just, he connects to what I'm doing. I don't know how else to explain that.
Mm-hmm. And he was on your latest.
Yes, he was on my.
Sorry, your latest.
No, he's on my
latest. Right,
Adventurous Monk, and he's on a record that I have coming out live at Smoke.
I've noticed those things, the blend of you and the drummer in a lot of your albums, through your soloing and motifs and connection, and also in comping, you know, and how you touched upon, if you could revisit like how you were mentioning, you know, the piano is a percussive instrument, and I think a lot of people tend to forget that actually and are always going for melodic lines. But just from what I've heard you do with comping, you're using the entire piano almost as more of a rhythmic instrument.
Mm-hmm. When I was playing in church on a regular basis, oftentimes the piano was the only instrument in the church other than the tambourine. So I wound up being the entire band. I had to play the bass part. I had to play an accompaniment part. And when there was no one singing, I'd also have to play the melody. So I was being the entire band and providing accompaniment for the various functions of the church service, whether it was the prayer or somebody singing a special song or for the offering or for a recessional or a processional. So being able to play piano in those different settings provided me with the necessary training and foundation for orchestrating situations and settings, scoring, if you will, almost, like scoring a scene in a movie. You know, the musicians in the church, they provide the score or the soundtrack for the church service. They underscore, and they provide the musical undercurrent for the flow of the service. So I was able to develop all sorts of different devices and techniques for what I'm doing now. And as an accompanist, specifically as a piano player, I'm in a strange position in the band because I'm right in the middle. I'm seasoning and filling the pot. You know, when you make a gumbo, they say the most important part of the gumbo is the roux, R-U-E. Or if you're cooking any other kind of thing, you know, what's your sauce going to be? I think in French culinary schools, I think you have to know how to make, there's five different sauces that are the main sauces for French cuisine. And I see myself as the sauce. I'm the seasoning. You know, you have the rhythm section that's providing the bottom or the foundation of the music. And then you have the horn players who are providing the melodic component. The piano player, or whoever the accompanist, whether it's vibes, the guitar, whatever the chords are, specifically in my case, the piano player, I'm filling everything in and making it all make more sense. Because when you have just melody and bass, musicians understand that. But I think what reaches people is hearing the chords. And that connects the top and the bottom, the top being the melody and the bottom being the rhythm. The chords in between help to make it all make sense. It's like, oh, okay, because the piano, to me, is what makes all of the grammar make sense. The melodies spell things out with the letters. And then the bass and drums, the rhythm, the foundation, they give you the context of what the letters are going to be used for. And then the piano, well, those are the words. Now you can make sentences. You don't just have letters. You don't just have this syntax and grammatical rules and things like that. You now have a context by which you can speak and use words. You now have a language, and the language makes more sense.
That's an amazing analogy. It's funny because I see a lot of pianists these days just so stuck in the middle register of comping. And when you explain it that way, it just, and I've heard your comping on a lot of various albums too. It's just like, I'll hear you playing bass notes. I'll hear you playing in the high end, in the middle end, leaving space. So basically, you're using everything to just propel the melody and the bass, just as you were talking about, correct?
Absolutely. A large part of that is because I get bored. The piano has 88 keys, and I get bored just staying in one range of the piano. Over time, my playing has become elastic. And I sort of, when I'm playing, I'm envisioning streams and running brooks and, you know, big high falls, like, you know, Niagara Falls and things like that. That's what I'm envisioning as I'm playing. So what I'm trying to do on the piano, I need to use all 88 of those keys to completely fulfill what it is I'm hearing and feeling. And it also requires that I employ bass players and drummers who are versatile in terms of where they can go musically. Because there may be a moment in the music where I'll really feel like evoking that bebop feeling, like that strong, authentic bebop feeling. And I'll need the drummer to be able to hear that and respond to it. Not so much with regard to playing out of a bag, but he certainly needs to understand the bag. He needs to understand the concept and the idea behind bebop in order for us to be able to evoke it authentically, but also be in the moment of the music. It's a complicated thing because as a historian of music, I've embraced all of what jazz is about, regardless of the period, regardless of the musician, regardless of the style. So I can easily dart in and out of different feelings and still make it contemporary in the sense that it's me. So you're not going to hear me and go, oh, man, that sounds just like Bud Powell. It might evoke the air of Bud Powell or even the essence of bebop, but it's not necessarily bebop per se.
It's
more abstract, you know.
Now, are those images or those inspirations coming to you based on a preconceived direction, or is it just in the spur of the moment that's what's coming up, like Niagara Falls is coming up, and then you're trying to, you know, use that as inspiration?
Well, that's my basic premise, is the flow.
I see.
Like water. Water is so essential to everything in life. You've heard terms, you know, fountain of youth, the water of life. And water is so essential to every aspect of life. That, to me, fuels and inspires what I'm doing. Ice means that everything is frozen and nothing can move. You're just stuck. So water has to flow. And water flows in all kinds of different directions. And water can also do some damage, too. But in terms of what I hear myself doing on stage, there always has to be this flow. And I think I tend to lean, and if it was up to me, I would play ballads for an entire hour. But I can't do that. I can't. I mean, maybe I could, but I don't think it would be. I don't know. I'll try it one day. I don't want to put people to sleep.
Right.
You know, you have to be diverse and versatile in your presentation of music. Now, Shirley Horn, she could pull that off. She could sing songs back to back that were all within a certain tempo or a certain dynamic range. But I'm not her. You know, I have to figure out a way to communicate to people using every single aspect of my skills, whatever I have at my disposal. But ballads are just such a source of beauty for me because it allows me to just completely get lost inside of the beauty that I'm trying to express.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. as far as ballads go. You know, it's just a completely different atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Would you recommend the use of imagery to students as a way to kind of, you know, remove the like thought process, like, oh, should I go to this note or go to this note? You know, so they're actually using imagery as a way to just kind of remove themselves and just flow naturally.
I don't know. Every student has to find his own source of inspiration. I'm inclined to not use imagery because everybody dreams differently. We dream and we imagine and create using different sources. Some people think colors. Some people think, like with me, it's water. Some people are, you know, more prone to nature. Some people are strictly geared towards the actual elements of music, be it melody, harmony, rhythm. They think only about the theory of what's being played. So, for instance, you know, a C13 chord, they're going to think about how many different ways can I play this certain scale or this certain pattern over this chord. John Coltrane was very much geared towards the theory of music versus Ornette Coleman, polar opposite of John Coltrane, whereas he came up with his own theory of music. So everybody's inspiration is going to come from a different place. Charlie Parker's inspiration came from the deep roots in Buster Smith and Johnny Hodges, Jimmy Dorsey? He's from his brother, yeah. Lester Young, obviously, Colin Hawkins, Art Tatum, and Charlie Parker used all of that and then said to himself, I'm hearing something else. I want to improvise in another way. I want to use more notes. I want to use a different succession of ideas. And I'm going to play these notes on these chords, which is not something that musicians were accustomed to doing. What motivates a person, what their impetus is going to be very different.
I see.
I don't know that I would necessarily use imagery specifically with every student. It depends on what that student can comprehend.
Like the level that they're at, basically, at that moment in time?
I don't know about level as much as place. Where are you in your life? I don't know that you can tell the average teenager who is a budding jazz musician, I want you to think about your life experience. Their life experience is 15 years. And not to diminish their life experience, but inside of 16, you could have experienced the death of your mother at a heart attack, the death of your father by murder. You yourself could have a child, you know, and then your life takes on a different meaning at 16 than the average 16-year-old because you've experienced so many significant events, whereas the average 16-year-old kid is not dealing with that. The average 16-year-old kid doesn't have to deal with that much death. Doesn't have to deal with being a father or a mother at 16 and trying to graduate high school and, oh, now you got to work. You know what I'm saying? So I can't necessarily say, hey, use your life experience to influence your work to the average teenager.
I see.
The average teenager is still in the educational phase of their lives. I'm talking about institutionalized education. So everything that they're doing is about learning something from a book or a classroom or, you know, these types of things, you know. They're going to have to stick more with the basic theory of music, and specifically with regard to jazz, they're going to have to do a whole lot of listening and then figuring out a way to take what they've listened to, learn it, process it through their own feelings and emotions. Oddly enough, to me, The best jazz musicians, you would think, would be teenagers because they're so emotional. teenagers are so out of whack emotionally. But you see, the problem is their emotions are not yet fully developed with regard to how they feel versus reality. Because no teenager lives in reality. They're too busy dealing with hormones and being told what to do and trying to process what it is they want to do in their lives, knowing that they can't do everything they want to do because they're not allowed to. But that type of emotional response, that type of emotional energy, I think I would encourage them to put all of that into their music. So instead of trying to deal from a place of imagery with a teenager, I would say, look, you know, and it's a tricky thing. You got to be careful about who you're talking to and how you're talking to them. But I would encourage them, listen, you know, you got a lot of things jumping off. Your hormones are going crazy. You know, your body's growing. Your mind is growing. I guess in a positive way, I would say put all of that energy into the music and figure out a way to make that a positive experience. Figure out a way to communicate that in your music.
I see. Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen a lot of different performances, and especially when you were teaching me, it was hard for me to do that as well with you. And I just remember feeling very timid and just not able to, because I hadn't gone through certain experiences and able to communicate fully. But how do you help someone? I see a lot of people who are timid or they're unable to connect with their emotions and just let go. You know, they're still kind of holding back. How would you recommend just helping them along that path to really just give it their all and just kind of let their emotions pour through them into the music?
Well, the one thing you have to do is to stop teaching them. I don't teach. I don't do private lessons anymore, and I have no real desire at this point to be involved on the educational front, because what I have discovered is far more successful and far more effective is mentoring. And that's different than teaching. Mentoring is like being a parent almost. You and I probably should have spent more time hanging out, going to check out music, being on the musical scene, being in musical environments.
I remember you doing that with me too. Sorry to interrupt,
but no problem.
I mean,
that was the idea.
Yeah, taking me out to gigs, and you introduced me to McCoy, and, you know, just we went to the Jazz Standard and ate dinner together. It was amazing. So I already saw that from you even 10 years ago.
Right. I don't think I knew then that my approach was overly academic. I wasn't really aware of it because I hadn't given it much thought. It was kind of something, like I said, just falling into jazz. It was something that I fell into. So the new school called me and said, hey, you know, we've got these students. Do you want to teach them? I said, sure. It was another source of income, and I didn't see a reason to say no. You know what I'm saying? I felt I was obligated to share this information that I had, which I still feel. It's just that now the context is different. So I now embrace opportunities where the environment is more about learning versus teaching. Now you might say, well, how can you learn if somebody's not teaching? It doesn't have to be this rigid pedagogic approach. I've learned so much more just from watching people and listening, and being curious. That is the only true way to learn. I went to my nephew's high school graduation yesterday, and I overheard some people talking about this one young lady who has been in high school 6 years because she can't pass this test that students have to take every year or so, every couple of years, some type of achievement test. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, why do they keep testing her then? Try something different. You know, we have this way we have what we call standardized tests.
Mm-hmm.
Standardized tests. Well, whose standard? It's a standard based on what exactly? Not every student is going to be a great test taker. Like you were saying about being somewhat timid and kind of reserved during our lessons. It's then that I began to discover that maybe this isn't really the approach for me. I'm not saying it's a bad idea for somebody else who's a better teacher. I'm saying for me, the way that I can get through to a student or to a young musician trying to learn this music can't be through one-on-one piano lessons.
Mm.
It's got to be through some other tailor-made approach that I design. It doesn't fall into a standardized set. So this poor young girl who can't test out of high school, well, unless she's going to have to age out eventually, but she keeps failing this test, they're going to have to figure out something different to get this information that they feel is important through to her. You see what I'm saying? So
yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes you have to adopt a different approach with different people. Not everybody is going to be able to succeed at doing something that the average person can succeed at doing. And again, who are we to decide what is average? To
right.
say, well, the average person knows how to do this, why don't you? And since you don't know how to do it, we're not going to let you get to the next level until you get. And it's like, wait a minute, that's oppressive, is what that is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
And
right.
I found that the most intriguing and successful people are the people who have not been so successful in the average setting. I believe it was Bill Gates. Didn't Bill Gates drop out of college or something like that?
Oh yeah.
Right. So this is now, on the other hand, it's in no way encouraging laziness encouraging the idea of quitting. Well, if you can't do it, just quit. No. What I'm saying is, figure out what it is that motivates you. Now, I knew when I was in high school that I had no intention of going to college. I knew it. I knew it then. Not because I was lazy. It's just because I knew that what I wanted to do wasn't going to require a college degree. And so I went out of my way to become successful in my field because I knew that I was going to have to do something. I said, if I don't get a degree, whether it's a bachelor's, master's, a doctor's, or whatever, I'm going to have to figure out something that's going to allow me to survive. And I'm going to have to do it with a quickness because college is coming up. And I wound up going for 1 year only because to get my parents off my back. And the first opportunity I had to go on the road, I jumped on it. I mean, I was out of there, man. I was gone and didn't look back. And then wound up teaching on the university level later on anyway, so I wound up in college anyhow. But by the same token, that for me is not where it's at. I'm not impugning the university system, jazz education, or anything like that. That's not my intent. I'm basically expressing that there are alternative forms of communication, alternative forms of being able to learn this music. But the most important environment is on the bandstand. Nothing can ever replace that. And you can hear the difference between the musicians from the 1940s versus the young musicians now. You can hear a difference because we talk about territory bands. If you know your jazz history, you know, bands that were in Kansas City and these bands that traveled all around the country. And they played in all these different venues and they had all these local spots that they could play in. Charlie Parker, during his tenures with Earl Hines, almost going out with Duke Ellington, his tenure with Dizzy, his tenure with Monk, his tenure up at Minton's, all these different experiences that he had, his tenure with Jay McShann, all these different experiences that he had then that no young musician can get now because times have changed. It's as simple as that. And that's the oversimplified reason, but that's the bottom line. Times have changed. Mm-hmm. Where are the dance bands? Where are the dance halls? Where are the, you know, the musicians used to play burlesque shows and things like that? The experiences are very different now. The average young musician can really only get his best experiences at universities. But then, once he graduates, then what? See, somebody like you, with the talent you had, you should have been able to graduate and then go into a band. To me, that seems to be the impetus for going to a jazz school in the first place.
Right.
I mean, otherwise, why bother? Because a degree in jazz music is only effective if you intend to continue teaching. But Wayne Shorter, Sonny Rollins, Eric Reed, Ron Carter, Cyrus Chestnut, Mark Cherry, we could care less what letters you have behind your name. We're not looking at your educational resume to hire you in a band. The bottom line is, people know if you can play. But that dynamic has changed because the bands are gone. There aren't nearly as many bands hiring young musicians as there were years ago. So, again, I don't teach. the learning, you see how I brought it full circle. The learning experience really takes place organically, on the bandstand, in those environments where the music is actually happening.
Yeah, I always question, well, not question, but I obviously learned a lot from the New School University and going through my degree, but, you know, obviously what we were doing was completely different than what I was doing in classrooms. And I always think to myself, well, if I had someone, you know, like Eric mentoring me and taking me around and just exposing me to those situations, where I'd be today, you know, how my path would have been differently. So, yeah, that learning experience is just invaluable.
What you're doing now, what you've gotten yourself into, is part of the process. It's part of the learning process. Because like I said, I don't want to completely dismiss jazz education. All of the elements, all the components are necessary. They just need to be more balanced. So you doing this interview and this whole program that you've got going is going to be beneficial because you're getting to talk to somebody like me who has been a part of the organic process of creating the music and has been on the other side, the non-educational side. You know, how I cut my teeth and how I came up in the scene, getting that information from me and being able to have that outlined so that somebody else can read it is also beneficial. We need everything. We need a balance.
And that's what I noticed, you know, through my upbringing, too, is that, you know, eventually, you know, now I realize that I didn't get enough of that, you know, I didn't get enough of those situations. And so I thought it would be great for students that were in my position, you know, when I was younger studying with you to have that experience, even if they couldn't get it from a university or something like that, they could hear you or other mentors speak about it and just kind of get a taste for what that's like. So absolutely. We only have a little bit of time left here, but I just have two specific questions that I want to get in here. One of my friends wanted me to ask, how do you approach half diminished chords? Because it seems that people don't really know how to go at those chords or the harmonies of them, or if you can just touch base on a half diminished 2-5-1 or something like that, that'd be great.
I say completely disregard the theory.
Okay.
And listen to the sound. Animals. We need to approach music like animals approach nature. We always make jokes about when earthquakes are getting ready to hit, or when some natural disaster is getting ready to strike, whether it's a hurricane or a tornado, the animals go all bat crazy. You know, dogs start barking and the birds start flying. You know, animals, and you can watch nature, and you can watch. How is it that we can tell the changing of the season, or, you know, watching the leaves turn brown or the leaves fall or the way the winds blow or when the rain comes down, and we can say, okay, these things are getting ready to happen. But some kind of way when it comes to music, all of a sudden it's, well, what scale do you play over that? You know, there's nothing more natural than music.
Right.
If you watched Leaves, if you listen to Leaves Fall, if you listen to, well, you don't hear Leaves Fall, but if you hear the wind bristling through the trees and you watch, just watch nature, just watch the world outside of you. All of that is musical. The whistling of the wind. There's sounds there. There's notes there. When you hear, I like water. So when you hear a waterfall, when you hear waters flowing through brooks and through streams and things like that, and you hear the waves crashing, and all that stuff, all of that is musical. But some kind of way, when it comes to playing music, we lose all sense of our natural inclinations. So, answering your question, I don't think about half diminished. I don't think about double diminished. I don't think about chromatic. I don't think about whole tone. I don't think about any of that. I think about one thing. One thing is all I think about: melody. Don't ever ask me what scale you play over a chord. The only answer I can give you is, what are you hearing in the sound? What is the sound? Right? You think about, you know, if you're driving someplace and you hear doo-doo-doo, that means get the f*** out of the way. You know how to respond to that yeah. sound, right? Okay.
Yep.
You're hearing a train coming. It's clang clang. Because all right, let's not go across these tracks. So you see what I'm saying? So
absolutely.
When it comes to music, respond to music the same way. That's a sound. Okay, what am I going to do here? And it's not 100% necessary for you to absolutely know that in the key of C major, or that in a C major chord, you play C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. No, that's beneficial in the sense of all of us playing together, and we all see the same chord there. So we kind of all have to play a similar idea or a similar sound, but it shouldn't limit the possibilities. That's basically what I'm trying to get at. So your friend that asked this question, how you approach a half-diminished chord, you approach a half-diminished chord by listening to it and responding to it. It's as simple as that. Now, I will say that the Bebop Cats used to call it the minor with the six on the bottom. And I think that's classical theory, or European theory, if I'm not mistaken. They didn't use the term minor 7 flat 5 or even half-diminished. They called it... With regard to theory and analyzing harmony, they call it minor with the six on the bottom. But you know, all of that, none of that's any good or important or significant if you don't know how to respond to it when you hear it. Looking at music, you know, Thelonious Monk, you know how complicated his music is. He used to teach the musicians he'd hire. He used to teach them his songs. Imagine, we're sitting there, we're trying to rehearse for a gig, and Thelonious Monk says, okay, all right, everybody, we're going to learn this song, Trinkle Tinkle. So everybody's looking for music. And there's not a sheet of music to be found, because Monk has not coughed it up.
Mm-hmm.
So they go, well, Monk, where's the music? Monk's like, I'm going to show it to you right now. So they're thinking in their minds, okay, well, maybe it's a simple song. And then Monk starts playing Trinkle Tinkle. They didn't wait a minute. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how are we going to get through this? And they'd be there for hours, man. It would take 2 and 3 hours to learn one song. But by the time you were finished, you learned that music.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that song. And you didn't ask Monk, hey, Monk, what scale do you play over this chord?
Right.
You knew the song well enough to only approach it from a melodic standpoint. So I can't stress melody enough, because for me, there's nothing more important when trying to improvise than being melodic.
One of the classes I had with Junior Mance, he taught us a blues. And basically, I'll never forget that, the melody he taught us. I think it was one of his own pieces, but it was just, I'll never forget it because he taught it to the whole class. And he, you know, he played it for us and just sang it to us and had us play it back to him. So, and so many of the pieces I learned in school and stuff like that, you know, just through sheet music, you know, I didn't retain, but that one I did. So,
Well, it's an interesting thing because in order to understand Duke Ellington's music, for instance, with arrangements and elaborate pieces like that, you've got to read that stuff. I mean, you've got to look at it and you've got to see, wow, Duke voiced the saxophone this way. How brilliant is that? That kind of stuff. But just in terms of improvisation and playing songs, I would have an environment that would probably have, well, again, for me, I'm always talking about balance. And when it comes to learning songs, something like Autumn Leaves, most musicians play that wrong because they don't know the melody. So when you hear musicians play it, they'll go, da 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 da. And the second time is the part that always trips them up because they're not thinking about the lyrics. They're only thinking about the melody, but they're not really thinking about the melody because they're playing it wrong, because they don't know the lyrics. So, the autumn leaves drift by my window. And that's the part they always get wrong, because they've heard somebody else play it wrong. So we just we have this tradition of just passing along misinformation. So with something like Autumn Leaves or Body and Soul or How High the Moon or anything like that, I strongly recommend learning those songs from the sheet music, because a lot of those songs had lyrics. What happens is once we go into instrumental versions, we dismiss the lyrics entirely, and now we're just playing like random melodies that are lazy versions or incomplete versions of the interpretation of the song. I'm kind of a stickler when it comes to melody, improvised or otherwise. So if you're improvising, I want to get a strong sense of your melodic approach. But if you're improvising over a pop song, whether it's I Get a Kick Out of You or some song by Stevie Wonder, say Summer Soft or something like that, I Wish, I want to be convinced that you actually know what the melody is before you start going off half-cocked, doing your own thing. Because what happens is we wind up with musicians who aren't really well-informed. They're so concerned and obsessed with doing their own thing, quote-unquote, that they haven't really put in the time to learn. So they just immediately jump to, this is my thing, I'm going to do this. And you pretty much wind up sounding like everybody else, just uninformed musicians.
I love it. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I felt the same way. That was one of the lessons that I learned from you even back then too, because I started learning, I think we were doing Night and Day, and you asked me if I'd looked at a the music with the lyrics on it or learned the lyrics. I said no, because I was missing a couple notes, you know. I was just reading it from a fake book. So I couldn't agree with you more. I love how the theme of the conversation has gone too, just because I don't think people address that type of conversation about jazz today and music, you know, having it actually be about music instead of study, you know, basically having it be about, you know, the expression and basically taking your experiences and putting it into it. And like you said, nowadays it feels like it's people don't put in the time, you know, to really ensure the proper delivery of the melodies and everything. And it's about trying to, you know, do what you want to do. Like, oh, I'm going to do my own thing, create this new sound, or, oh, I'm developing this new sound. But it's like, well, what about all this other stuff you haven't done? So
that's right. Well, there's got to be a balance. And we have to constantly dispel the myth. And it's on one level, it's actually kind of racist. We have to dispel the myth that people like Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker were not studied musicians. Louis Armstrong studied privately. But that's little known because that's not emphasized. Charlie Parker studied privately. You can listen to him play, and you can hear things from the Closé studies book. You can hear direct links to what you would learn in private instruction. And you don't get to play like Charlie Parker without studying and practicing. Because people would think, well, it's like, you know, he's this black guy, he's this jazz musician, he's uneducated, he didn't go to college, so he couldn't possibly have practiced this stuff. He's just a genius. And that's not a compliment. Saying somebody is just a genius and dismissing any notion that they actually practiced, that's hardly complimentary. That's saying that they're lazy, didn't put in the work, and that God just magically said here. You know what I'm saying? On the one hand, This Paul Bunyan-esque like attitude that we have of Charlie Parker is that, my God, he's so tremendously gifted. He's so tremendously talented. He couldn't have gotten that just from practicing and studying. And that's the truth right there. He didn't just. He was actually anointed to do what he did. So, yes, there is a special thing that you don't get from any amount of practice or any amount of study. Some things people are just blessed to be able to do what they do. Picasso, Duke, Art Tatum. And the truth in that lies in the fact that if I'm wrong, then everybody should be doing it. But you see, everybody's not doing it. They're doing something that most of the rest of us either cannot or won't do.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's great to hear. All your points are just so intelligent. It was really great to have you on the show today. Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. You know what? I apologize. I realized it was a show. Are you going to be able to? Is this live?
No, it's not live. I can edit it. So I'll bleep the language out. No
the
problem.
Language, yeah. Sorry about that.
No problem. No problem at all. So if people are looking to hear you or, you know, learn more information about you or buy your albums, what's the best place for them to go do that?
My website is ericreed.net. My tour schedule stays current. You can purchase CDs through PayPal from me on there. And, you know, I also have a blog. It's called Reed's Creeds. And I'm very active on social media. You know, I have a Twitter account. I have a Facebook account. You know, this is the part about trying to remain relevant that I was talking about. You know, I don't want to keep saying, oh, you young musicians, you know, you're missing out and you didn't have this. It's like, I don't want to do that. I try to use what information that I have to disseminate in whatever way I can.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of constantly talking about the current generation and how they suck. You know,
that's
completely counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
And untrue. I mean, there's a bunch of great musicians today who I love listening to. Christian Sands and Sullivan Fortner, Aaron Deal. Love listening to these young guys. And they have something to say. And it's something different than what other people have said.
Yep. Well, yeah, thank you so much again. I appreciate it. I always remember you staying up to date on your gadgets. So it helps when people are you know, connecting, you know, with the public, and I think you're doing a great job of that, so I really appreciate it, and I'm sure other people do as well.
Well, thank you, Brendan. I appreciate you reaching out to me.
Yeah, great. So that's it. I appreciate your time, and you know, hopefully maybe we can get you back on the podcast later in the year or sometime in the future again.
That sounds great.
Okay, Eric, thanks so much. Take care.
Not a problem. You take care.
Well, there you have it, folks. Eric Reed. That was such a fun interview to do. I was a little nervous in the beginning just because it was the first big interview I'd done on a more serious note, besides my good friend. So, but it was fun. It was very, very enjoyable. Got through it. And for the next interview, I'm trying to get Aaron Goldberg on the show, which would be really, really awesome. He grew up in my hometown, and he's done a couple master classes for my high school when I was attending high school there for the jazz band. So I had contacted him already, so he should be on the show mid-June, which will be awesome. And in the next interview, I'll definitely get rid of my ums and my uh-huhs. I heard that while I was listening back to all of it. But thanks for your support. If you guys could leave a 5-star rating, I'd really, really appreciate it. I say this at the end of the podcast. I know I sound like a broken record, but I only do it because it's so important for the exposure of the podcast and for other people to find it. So if there's any one thing you can do to say thank you for having these guests on and doing the podcast, it would be to leave a 5-star rating. You don't even have to leave a review, although I would appreciate it always. You can just click on the 5 stars, and just that, just by having that extra 5-star rating, it will really, really help the podcast. And it's completely free. All you have to do is click the mouse, go to a link, click the mouse, and you're done. And when I wake up in the morning, I have that much more motivation to continue the podcast and keep getting guests on here. So as always, guys, thank you so, so, so much for listening. It was so much fun to do that. I can't wait to have more guests on, and happy practicing.